Hello and welcome to episode 123 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me as always, and happy to have him back, is retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine Indianapolis Commodore Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor. Many other postings. How are you this new year, Bill?
I'm all recovered, Seth, so I'm glad to be back.
Excellent. Glad to have you back, too. And this week, we are always happy to welcome back our good friend, historian John Parshall. John, how are you this new year?
I, too, am just delightful.
Outstanding.
Yes.
Not delighted, but delightful.
Delightful. I heard that. Hey, whatever it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, this is the moment that I personally, and I know John too, have been waiting for right here. I'm going to be perfectly honest with everyone. This is the very fight that I've waited to talk about since Bill and I first discussed doing this podcast. I've waited for this very moment right here. To put it into perspective, I'll remind you that the last episode, in which Bill unfortunately was absent for, and that John and I helmed the barroom brawl, we talked about the first naval battle of Guadalcanal. In that Friday the 13th melee, a heavily outgunned and outnumbered U.S. Task Force 67 to be exact, quite literally drove itself into the middle of a Japanese battleship cruiser and destroyer formation and slugged it out with them at frighteningly close range and took a beating, but delivered a beating in return. The outgunned U.S. force drove the Japanese off, denied them their mission of bombarding Henderson Field, and in return allowed the aircraft from Henderson to deliver the coup de grace, the finger in the eye, if you will, so to speak, as the TBFs, SPDs, and even B-17s dropped ordnance all over the battleship Hiei and harassed the Japanese all the way back through the slot. The Japanese, nothing if not determined, decided that they would continue in their mission to bombard Henderson and reinforce the beleaguered troops ashore again, this time with a smaller force, albeit still powerful, centered around the battleship Kirishima. To answer the threat he knew was coming, Admiral Halsey sent the only two remaining heavy surface units at his disposal, who were at the time screening the battered but invaluable aircraft carrier Enterprise. 1915 hours on November 13th, signalmen aboard the battleship USS Washington received the following message from Admiral Halsey, quote, "To Commander Task Force 64, proceed north with both battleships and your four destroyers at best speed," unquote. Task Force Commander, an admiral known as Ching, turned to his signalman and said, "Signal Enterprise and proceeding north." With that, the throttles aboard the two American battleships opened up wide, increasing speed to 28 knots. The Leviathans and their tiny destroyer escorts plowed through the wide open spaces off Noumea, bound for the close confines of Savo Sound, with arrival set for the following night. The stage was set for a collision of monsters, the likes of which had not been seen in the Pacific Ocean since Admiral Dewey in Manila. And even then, nothing like this. On the night of November 14th, 15th, the seas around Guadalcanal would erupt in furious gunfire yet again and would become known as the night the Giants rode across Iron Bottom Sound. Oh, yeah. All right. Yes, I know, man. It's just freaking cool. It is.
Yeah.
Let's get after it.
The preeminent battleship fight probably of the 20th century, at least from the Americans' point of view, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
The Brits would have some things to say about that, of course.
Yeah, I know. I was having...
Bismarck, sorry.
Yeah. The ship that must not be named. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So let's give a brief setup to the events here. The night before, or actually two nights before, technically, because the Japanese came through with a cruiser force and pounded Henderson Field after the barroom brawl.
Correct.
But we're looking at two naval forces, guys, that have really been beaten down. And I'm talking both Japanese and the United States. I mean, we've taken a beating. We've delivered a beating. The Japanese have taken a beating. They've delivered a beating. I mean, these are two naval forces that are, frankly, they're worn out. You know, they're worn out. John, can you give us some kind of a perspective as to what we're looking at, aside from what I just said here? I mean, you know, what are the Japanese thinking at this moment?
Well, you're right. They are recognizing that this is a do or die kind of fight. They are very tired, but they do have a substantial number of heavy surface units still in this immediate, you know, fairly immediate neighborhood. The carrier forces are beaten up by this point very badly and are out of the fight. So we really are down to surface forces primarily. But back at Truk, Admiral Yamamoto is in Yamato, and the battleship Mutsu is also close at hand, which is a 16-inch gun vessel, a very powerful battleship in her own right. And then further south, cruising around Ontong Java Atoll, are three fast battleships, not only Kirishima, but also Haruna and Kongo, her two sisters. And Admiral Kondo, who's the gentleman in charge of that surface force, knows that he needs to somehow put Henderson Field out of business. And it's, again, we sort of alluded to this in the last episode. I do not understand why he did not make the decision to detach both Haruna and Kongo to go along south with Kirishima. But nevertheless, that was the decision that was made. Understand, too, Yamamoto is a very unhappy gentleman at this point, because with the defeat of Abe's task force and the sinking of Hiei two nights before, he relieves Abe of command. Abe is going to be drummed out of the Navy at the beginning of 1943, and he now turns it over to Kondo and basically says, go and get done what your subordinate failed to do two nights ago. Hmm.
So why, you know, again, I know we don't have a definite answer as to why he sends these battle wagons out there, battle cruisers, however you want to phrase it, piecemeal. But, you know, you think possibly, I mean, you know, one would say, at least with Yamato, it was probably a fuel issue, but that's just my guess. I don't know. But if the other battles...
Well, the fuel issue lasted the entirety of the war then, if that was Yamato's problem, right?
Yeah, the other thing that's going on here, frankly, is that in Japan's eyes, there is a distinct difference between a unit like the Yamato and a unit like the Kirishima. It was understood in the Imperial Navy that Battleship Division 3, which is composed of the four Kongo-class battleships, was not fit to stand in the main line of battle with units like Yamato or Mutsu or Nagato. And so I think part of what's going on here is there's a hedging of bets that if we do get into a decisive naval action that requires the Japanese main battle line, that they want that battle line to be as intact as possible. So they're not going to risk units like Yamato or Nagato or Mutsu down in Iron Bottom Sound. But that Div 3 is seen as more expendable. That said, I don't understand why they wouldn't send all three of them down there.
And that's my point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, their whole doctrine was based on decisive force, even in micro, you know, situations. And so the fact that they would send like a third of their battle force fleet down to engage and finish off the Americans, and they don't do that, just I can never understand that.
Well, some of it may also be a function of just how constricted the waters are around Iron Bottom. And actually, that's something I want to, you know, just we should talk about in general, because when I think about this engagement, it literally makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up because it's so incredibly dangerous. By this point in time, you know, the dangers of torpedo attack from the Japanese are self-evident.
Over and over again.
But the thing that a lot of people can't, it's hard to visualize just how small a body of water Iron Bottom Sound is. If you're standing on the tip of the runway on Henderson Field, it is only 22 miles to Tulagi, which means that a battleship can literally fire a shell all the way across this sound. Battleships are open water creatures. They like to have lots of elbow room to
maneuvering room.
Right? And so, you know, from Halsey's perspective, if you think about just how incredibly dangerous it is to take his two remaining heavy surface units into Iron Bottom Sound, it's the nautical equivalent of a cage match, okay? There's only three entrances into the sound. All of them are pretty constricted. If you get into trouble there, it's really, really difficult to get out of trouble cleanly. So,
and these ships don't turn tight. You know, the joke, even when I was on a Trident submarine, was put the rudder over and wake me up when we're on course. And these battleships were just as bad.
Probably worse.
Well, except for the Iowa class. So there's a little segue there. The Iowa class, those puppies maneuvered almost like destroyers. And there are some pretty hair-raising stories from that whole community about some maneuvers that the Iowas were capable of doing. But anyway, that is not what we're dealing with here. Right. But yeah, Iron Bottom is a really small body of water. And it may well have been that the Japanese are like, man, I don't want to have to maneuver three battleships in that. Two was hairy enough as it was. So
yeah. It is. It's tighter than two coats of paint, as the saying goes.
Yeah.
But you know, from Halsey's point of view, he had nothing left or nothing substantial left.
That's right.
I mean, he literally
the majority of the fighting force.
This is it. And I mean, you know, to your point about the aircraft carriers, Japanese and American. I mean, at this point, the Enterprise is the last of the Mohicans, man. I mean, that is it. She is the last CV American aircraft carrier in the Pacific Ocean at this operable at this time. That is it. And, you know, and even then she you know, you're talking less than a month after Santa Cruz where she took a beating. I mean, she got those patchwork repair there at Espirito. But even then that was, you know,
it gives you an indication of just what kind of an individual Halsey was, that, you know, this is a guy who is willing to push all the chips to the center of the table. He will fight you down to the last bloody rowboat to preserve this island. He's sort of made an emotional commitment to Vandergrift that I'm going to give you everything I have. And he's not kidding. So again, we see this sort of pattern though, between the Japanese and the Americans where, you know, Halsey is all in, even though the risks are appalling. The Japanese, we're kind of all in, you know, but we're not willing.
But
to
not
commit.
Really.
Yeah. But not really.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, let's dive a little deeper into the Halsey battle wagon, you know, commitment issue here, if you want to call it such. So the two ships that he sends out there are Washington and South Dakota, and we're going to talk about Washington almost exclusively because she's badass, but we'll talk about both of them here. So BB-56, which of course is Washington, she was designed to be a sniper. You know, she was not a Bismarckian, you know, brawling close in pounder. She was a long range sniper. And to that end, you know, she was designed that way. She wasn't designed to be a close-in brawler. She didn't have the armor protection that the previous generation of battleships had. You know, what did they call it? The all or nothing armor scheme, you know, where it was just a turtle with guns, you know,
traded off for speed so she could keep up with the carriers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, to a point. Yeah. I mean, you know, that whole redesign, and I'm not going to get into that because there are far better informed people than I on naval architecture and designs pre-World War II. But the whole reason that, you know, the fast battleships came into being was to keep up the carriers, to your point. But it was, you know, a part of it. But I mean, that's what Washington was designed to do. And she's, of course, the second and last ship of this class, North Carolina class battleship. North Carolina, we've already talked about her at Eastern Solomon. She sucked up a torpedo too.
Yeah.
But you know, she was fast. Washington was fast by battleship standards. You know, she could do 28 knots ish and, you know, maybe 30 going downhill, maybe. But I mean, you know, as I said, she didn't have that armor to really take too much of a pounding.
She's not ill protected, but by the standards of the day. In comparison to South Dakota, which was a shorter vessel, had a much more concentrated armor citadel. She's. Sodak is in a better position to absorb a real beating if need be.
Do any of them have water armor below the waterline for torpedo attacks?
Yeah, they both have you know, sloping armor belts that go down below the waterline to a certain degree. And I used to be very up on battleship underwater protective schemes, but that was about 20 years ago when I was doing that feature on my website. Suffice to say that both of these vessels are capable of absorbing a torpedo hit. You'll notice that when North Carolina got tagged by a submarine torpedo, the same spread that did in the Wasp, that she just shrugged that off and didn't even lose any speed. So American underwater protective schemes were pretty robust, but to an extent, it also depended on where in the ship you got hit. that protective scheme is only effective in the middle portion of the vessel. The extremities are not nearly as well protected, particularly the bow.
Right. And South Dakota, she had a smidgen less torpedo protection than did Washington, but not yes. much. But I mean, again, if you get tagged with one torpedo, like you said, with North Carolina, it might be okay. But if you get tagged with three or the spread of three or four from a destroyer,
you got a problem.
Yeah,
the Long Lance, and bear in mind that the Long Lance has a larger warhead than the Type 95 that was fired by a Japanese submarine. So, you know, could these battleships absorb one or two Long Lances? Yes, I absolutely. You know, start talking three or four, and yeah, you got a problem.
Yeah.
The other advantage that South Dakota has in a fight like this, and this was something that wasn't understood at the time when she was designed, but it was sort of revealed in post-war studies, the fact that South Dakota has an outboard plate of 1.5-inch special treatment steel has the effect of it would decap any incoming heavy armor-piercing shell, rip the windscreen off of it, and also rip the soft cap, which means that that shell would have less penetrative ability when it actually hits the main armor belt. So, you know, this is kind of esoteric stuff, but the bottom line is that South Dakota is demonstrably the better protected of these two ships.
Mm-hmm. If there was a fast battleship that was going to be a brawler, South Dakota class battleships would have been
yes.
that animal.
Yes.
But still, to the point of being that, you know, what we were trying to say is that Halsey did not want these things to brawl if he could avoid it.
Then again, by the very geography of the place that he is sending them into,
he didn't have much of a choice.
Yeah, this is what you're up for.
So the guy, and I wanted to talk about this cat for a long time. He's a person that a lot of people don't know about. They may have heard the nickname, but they still don't know who the hell he is or was, rather. The gentleman that's in charge of this task force, which is 64, I believe, Task Force 64, the battleship task force with the four destroyers, is an admiral by the name of Willis Lee. His nickname was rather unfortunate one by today's standards, Ching. His nickname was Ching Lee. He, and I don't think this could be argued, was literally the perfect choice to run this operation. If Christ himself said, he could not have picked a better man to do this than Willis Lee. I mean, he was born to do this specific fight.
Yeah.
He's a fascinating guy, absolutely fascinating. Naval Academy class of 1908. This is where he gets the nickname Ching. Bill can talk about unfortunate nicknames at the Academy. But
mine was Taco, and I'm Italian, right? So right. You don't get to choose your call signs.
He apparently was given the nickname Ching because of his fondness for the Asian culture and his desire to serve in the Asiatic theater of operations. Mm. But he was not your prototypical looking American admiral.
Yeah.
He was
short, pigeon-toed, bad eyesight, which is ironic because he was also an Olympic caliber rifleman.
Yes.
Gold medalist, wasn't he?
Gold medalist, yeah.
Five gold medals.
Yeah.
He won the most gold medals of any American until Spitz. Something like that. Yeah.
That's correct. But, you know, he's got Coke bottle glasses by this time. And, you know, one American officer described him as looking like an Arkansas farmer.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the Kentucky drawl, you know, so he does not look as if he's the sort of gentleman that has a mind that is made of, you know, parabolas and quadratic
windage charts.
So another thing about him is he has just a freakish spatial awareness. I was actually talking to a Navy surface warfare officer this weekend about mobility boards, maneuver boards, you know, that you use those when you're trying to figure out, okay, I'm going to change my formation and I've got to be at this point at this time, you know, and my speed is this, but I'm going to have to change it to be that, you know, you actually physically plot out using parallel rulers and pencil and, you know, compass and all that.
Way stuff. Too many hours doing that on maneuvering boards.
You've done this, okay?
Yes.
Willis Lee didn't use maneuvering boards. Willis Lee didn't need maneuvering boards. Mm-hmm. He could just do this stuff in his head, okay? Even during divisional maneuvers, he declined using that stuff because he didn't need it. So he's got a scary intellect, and he's a gunnery specialist. Mm. He really understands the math behind all this stuff. And bizarrely, for an officer of his age, he is intimate with radar systems, understands them in a way that a lot of 20-year-old whiz kid techs at the time did not understand them. And so, yeah, Seth, you're absolutely right. You know, you could not have asked for a finer officer to be in a night fight involving radar assisted gunnery.
Yeah. And just to give the listener a bit of a background, you know, we talked about his gold medals, you know, and I mean, he won 7 medals, 5 gold, holy 1 cow. Silver, 1 bronze, for Christ's sake.
Silver and the bronze,
as a shooter. And he had Coke bottle glasses, to John's point. I mean, seriously, look up, I'll put pictures of him on there. But the early part of his service, like he was never an officer who went and did submarines or carriers. It was all gunboats.
Guns.
Destroyers, cruisers, battleships.
Guns.
And when he wasn't at sea, he was with Bureau of Buord. Ordnance. Yeah, with Buord. And he was doing gunnery, and he was inspecting powder plants and
designing.
I mean, the guy scratch built weapons, for Christ's sake, that he used to shoot rats with aboard the ships, for guy and I. You know? I mean,
yeah. And I got to say this, because a lot of people have intellect but not the physical courage, or they're, you know, fighting admirals that had the physical courage but not the intellect. Halsey, sorry, that was a cough.
Somerville.
But Lee had both. I mean, he was willing and able to stand toe-to-toe, you know, in a pitched battleship against battleship, and do all these calculations in his head as to what the best trajectory for the guns would be
and
best firing position and things like that, while staring down the enemy. And there weren't many people who could do both.
Mm-mm. Yeah. You know, he was considered in 1942, the United States Navy considered him to be the foremost expert in naval gunnery. And that's not my opinion. That is a fact. Like, he was considered to be the man when it came to naval gunnery.
Yeah. And one of the few people that Admiral King actually liked. I think maybe that number is less than 5 in the entire world.
There are a lot of humans on the planet that can claim that.
Exactly.
I would just go ahead, Seth.
Well, now I was going to say, and I was going to ask you, John, I mean, I looked into why King, and he did. I mean, again, you know, King was apparently, he was like, please, you know, Willis Lee, he sent Willis Lee out to the Pacific and then said, oh, hey, by the way, Chet, I'm sending this cat out to you. And Nimitz was like, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Mm-hmm. But he
knew it. Nimitz knew and liked him well as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But he never really had too many run-ins positive or negative, with Admiral King. So I'm not really sure. I don't know if it was a fitness report thing or if it was just a word of mouth thing, but King thought he hung the moon.
Right. Right. Well, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, there's a backstory to this too. You know, Washington had actually been operating in the Atlantic for the first months of this war, spent a lot of time up in Iceland because the Brits were extremely uptight about Tirpitz. And so they wanted an American battleship up in those waters. Well, King was just dying for an opportunity to get them out of there. I think Convoy PQ-17 in July really sort of put the icing on that cake. And you know, anyway, Lee is in the Pacific, and he's the right guy for the job. And I should also mention for our viewers, if anyone is interested in a really good biography of Lee, it's been long overdue, but Paul Stillwell just put one out in I believe last year, 2022, and I've got it, and it's wonderful and well worth a read.
Battleship Commander. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It is
great.
It is
book.
Outstanding, easy read too.
Yeah.
Really, sometimes really, biographies aren't, but this one was.
Paul's a great author, and it really reads well. So
absolutely.
Anyway.
So he gets out to the Pacific, Willis Lee does, and Admiral Nimitz has a quote that he says, I forget who he said it to. I think he said it to Layton, Edwin Layton. He told Edwin Layton, he said, now we'll see what a real fighter can do, when he sent Lee out to the South Pacific. So, I mean, that'll give you some kind of inclination as to how highly this man was thought of, who, by the way, had, aside from squatting down on the deck of, I forget which ship it was in during the Banana Wars, and taking pot shots at snipers with a 1903 rifle and hitting them, by the way. Lee had never heard a shot fired in anger aside from ones that he had sent from an 03 at right. enemy snipers in the Caribbean. But regardless of that, he goes out to the Pacific initially, and he rides South Dakota out there, because South Dakota, as we've mentioned before, was built to be a flagship. She had admiral's quarters and all that stuff. Well, South Dakota, before she ever really even gets into the fray, she runs aground. And Willis Lee has to transfer his flag, and eventually he makes his way to USS Washington, which is, without a doubt, very fortuitous for all the forces, American side anyway, that are going to be involved in this. Because if he could have picked a ship, which of course he could have, I guess, if he could have picked a ship, Washington would have been the one that he would have picked. And it so happens that he, for the rest of the war, he kind of makes Washington his home. I think he spends time aboard New Jersey for a little while, but for the most part, Washington is his flagship for the remainder.
And, he got aboard before Washington even got that SG radar installed. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah,
she takes there. Yeah. When that goes aboard her. Yeah.
Cause well, he could oversee the installation, I guess.
He did oversee the installation.
Again, you know, this is not something that flag officers do, you know, is oversee the installation of a highly
let me know when it's done.
Yeah, right. You know, don't come.
But it's great because he's deciding the location of the repeaters on the flag bridge, so he can watch how the gunfire splashes are happening and things like that. That's incredible.
This guy is so deep in the weeds. Yeah, he can't even see daylight. But you know, God bless him. So anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but as you mentioned, Washington's got a great gunnery department.
Yeah, they do. And I was going to say, let's talk about the Big Wash or Rusty W, whatever nickname you want to bestow upon her. She, Washington had a core crew that would have made literally any ship blush. I mean, the core of officers, JOs, and sometimes a little bit above that, were, you know, all led by a guy named Glenn Davis. Glenn Davis was the captain of USS Washington. He later acquires flag rank and becomes Admiral Glenn Davis. But at this point, he is Captain Glenn Davis. And Glenn Davis is one of those guys that is, you know, he's kind of like Willis Lee to a point here. He's whip smart. His crew worship the ground that he walks on. He's stern, but he's not a jackass. And, you know, he's not a martinet, but he's just a good captain. He's a good man. And he has underneath him some of the brightest minds in gunnery in the United States Navy outside of Willis Lee. And these are all people that, you know, later on in the war become, you know, gunnery officers of like one of them. I think it's Hooper becomes the gunnery officer aboard USS Alaska. And, you know, there's guys that most of them achieve flag rank by the end of their career. I mean, these are some smart individuals. One in particular is a guy you're going to hear his name spit out quite a bit here in this next few minutes, a guy named Lieutenant Commander Edwin Hooper. Hooper was, he was from New England, so he pronounced his name Hoopa, as I say, but he was a graduate of MIT. So, I mean, this is not some, you know,
that's yokel. Very unusual for, you know,
yeah, that's weird officer right there.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus God. He was the ship's fire control officer and assistant gunnery officer. He's not even the gunnery officer. He's the assistant gunnery officer. Like Lee, he was an advocate of superior marksmanship. Being a gunnery officer, that would, you know, make sense.
Kind of the thing, yeah.
But he dove, like Lee, headfirst into ballistics and trajectory and all these scientific equations that literally make my head hurt, that he could just wrap his brain around in conversation like we're having right now. So he and Lee became like, they were like long lost cousins when they got aboard Washington, because they were just, you know, yakking about this constantly. And his commanding officer, Hooper's commanding officer, was a guy named Harvey Walsh, Commander Harvey Walsh. There was another one, Lieutenant Commander Harry Seeley. Seeley was the main battery spotting officer. Captain Jonas Platt was a secondary battery officer. And even to a point, Lieutenant Commander Ed Shansey, who was the ship's navigator, they all routinely met in, I believe it was Admiral Lee's quarters, if I'm not mistaken, and they convened almost nightly what they called the gun club. And they sat around and talked about theory and, you know, all this mind-blowing stuff.
Calibration and exactly.
Yeah,
and calibration is important. You know, it again, it's tough for us at 80 years removed to sort of get our minds around how fire control was done at this point in time. You know, the digital computer was not yet a thing. And so the fire control instrumentation on these battleships were these gigantic analog computers that you would feed your ship speed, your own course, things like wind velocity, and of course the target's perceived course and speed. But these machines would even compensate for things like the Earth's Coriolis effect. In other words, the Earth is continuing to spin underneath this warship after you fired your shell, and that's going to impart a slight curvature to the trajectory of that shell. I mean, yeah you talk about mind-boggling stuff. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What I was going to say is people in 2022 don't understand how precise and accurate, those aren't the same thing, these analog computers were. When I joined my first submarine in 1981, we had analog fire control computers to direct our torpedo launches, even in the 1981. And they were they operated better than the digital computers that came along, because the digital ones, initial ones, didn't have enough computing power to make up for the precision of the analog systems that preceded them. So in World War II, all of the torpedo data computers on submarines were analog computers. And that is not an oxymoron, analog computer. And these battleships had very sophisticated analog computers.
They had whole rooms designed for this very purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to the point, when the Iowa-class battleships were recommissioned again and were used in the 1980s, they didn't replace the computers on those at all. All they did
The gunfire computers, right?
Correct. They figured out a way to mate a laser rangefinder with that and put that in as an additional input into that analog system. But there was no need to replace it because it was perfectly good. So
anyway. Under Captain Davis, and while he's got gunnery officers, I mean everybody answers to the boss. Glenn Davis informed his officers that this is what I want done, and his officers like Ed Hooper and Chauncey and all the Harvey Walsh and all these people, they drilled their gunnery crews to a razor's edge of efficiency. The book said that you could load and fire a 16-inch naval rifle in 30 seconds, which is cooking. But I mean, you're talking a lot of lead. I mean, that's 2,700 pounds of shell alone, not mentioning the powder and all this other stuff.
And the powder bag was separate from the shell. So this is very complex.
This is something that it's like an assembly line. But 30 seconds was the prescribed time. Walsh had his people trained so well that they could fire these suckers in between 15 to 20 seconds, the 16-inch naval rifles on USS Washington.
Yeah.
That is ungodly.
Yeah, really, really fast. I mean, that's absurdly fast. And my guess is they probably couldn't have kept that up, hour over hour, but these engagements don't typically last that all mm-hmm. that long. And so, having that sort of burst fire capability, real important.
Big time. And we're going to see that here in just a minute. But we mentioned training, John, and I know you wanted to talk about this with the USS Atlanta.
Yeah. So there was a gentleman named Lloyd Mustin, who also goes on to achieve flag rank later in his career. And he was the assistant gunnery officer on board the Atlanta. Obviously, this was before the barroom brawl engagement. But during one of these gunnery training exercises, Washington is practically over the horizon. She's at 32,000 yards. The only thing the guys on Atlanta can see of her are the tops of her masts. And the game is that Washington is using Atlanta as a target, but she is offsetting her battery by roughly 2 degrees astern of Atlanta. And so if everything is correctly calibrated, those shells from Washington should come right down in Atlanta's wake. And that's exactly what Mustin tells us, that you would see the detonation of the guns, and then you're kind of waiting around for the minute and a half or whatever it takes for those shells to land. But they salvo after salvo just nailed into Atlanta's wake a few hundred yards astern. So yeah, Washington was an assassin.
Mustin goes on to say, he says, quote, I love this, he says, those 2,700 pound armor piercing projectiles were going to be very bad news for anybody they were ever aimed at, unquote.
Yes,
exactly. Indeed they will be. Indeed. Yep. All right, let's get to it. Let's get to the shooting here. There's Japanese ships that are coming down for this fight. There are quite a few of them, you know. No surprise here. The Japanese have got more forces to throw into the fire than we do. 14 in number, if I'm correct here. They were assigned, of course, to bombard Henderson Field yet again on the night of 14-15 November under the direction of Kondo, as we said. The ships are, of course, and is it Kirishima or Kirishima? I've always said Kirishima.
You can do it either way.
Tomato, honestly. Tomato.
Yeah, tomato, okay. Tomato. Yeah. Yeah. I usually say Kirishima, but yeah.
So we got the one battle wagon coming down.
Yep.
We got two heavy cruisers, Takao and Otago. And then we've got two light cruisers, Nagara and Sendai. Yep. And then we got nine destroyers, of which I'm not going to name all of them, but there's nine destroyers. So it's a pretty stout.
It's a pretty beefy force. And again, the real firepower in this formation is at the top and the bottom of the batting order. You've got Kirishima's guns, and you've also got nine destroyers worth of long lances sitting at the bottom there. Mm-hmm. So although, you know, should not discount the torpedo firepower that is on both of the heavy cruisers as well. Both Takao and Otago carry, 16 torpedo tubes apiece. So these are pretty beefy customers.
And those 8-inch guns on those heavy cruisers are nothing to sneeze at either.
Yeah.
As we saw, as Hiei found out the hard way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the U.S. force, as I said, was designated Task Force 64, of course, under the command of Admiral Willis Lee, consisted of two battleships, Washington and South Dakota, four destroyers, Walk, Preston, Benham, and Gwin. And that's
just the most pathetic screen I think you could come up with for two battleships. I mean, that screen should be four times that number, honestly.
But it shows you what you got to deal with. You
know? Yeah.
With a couple of cruisers.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
think?
This is pathetic.
Yeah.
But there's no way we should win this battle.
But when that's all you got, that's all you got. You're scraping the barrel.
And since I play the role of John Madden in these podcasts, that's why they play the game, right?
That's why they play the game. Well, you know, and it's intriguing, though, again, that the formation for the Japanese formation, its name is the Emergency Bombardment Force. Okay. Right. So there's a sense of urgency on the part of the Japanese. They understand that they're kind of having to scrape this thing together because two nights ago, things did not go well. But again, you know, why weren't they coming with three battleships? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, anyway. It's a good thing that they don't, but
yeah, it is a good thing that they don't, because okay, Kirishima is a World War I era combatant, and she's got the protective schemes to show for it. Particularly, her underwater protection is just terrible. But again, in the closed confines of Iron Bottom Sound, a 14-inch rifle is nothing to sneeze at either, and you know, they only brought eight to the party. They could have brought 24 of those rifles to the party if they had brought all three ships. But yeah, that's what we got.
So the American ships are lined up in basically a straight line. That's how Willis Lee aligns these vessels with the DDs in the lead, followed by Washington and Sodak. She's bringing up the rear. At around, what was it? I lost my damn place. 1600. Lee receives a sighting report from the submarine USS Trout that identified the Japanese bombardment or emergency bombardment force and mentioned a Japanese battleship in that same force. Mm-hmm. Knowing that the Japanese force would not reach Savo until around 2300-ish, Lee waited before making his approach into the patrol area to a point. Bill, what's up with the Trout?
The Trout, you know, Trout is a remarkable submarine, and I'm long to talk about submarines on our podcast, and this is one of my first opportunities.
We're getting there.
We're a year into the war, and this is Trout's sixth war patrol.
Wow.
A year into the war. And she actually received 11 battle stars. And this is the more remarkable statistic, 3 presidential unit citations.
Wow.
Which is incredible. During the course of the war, before she was sunk with all hands in 1944, she was trying to get into the East Sea and do some inland, you know, melee. And so very sad story at the end, but this ship performed heroically. It was the stuff of movies. Now she did, when she sighted this specific Japanese task group, she did fire a salvo of 6 torpedoes against the Kirishima. And they did not work. I mean, this is like the greatest crime of on the American side of World War II is how bad our torpedoes were for the first 2 years of the war. And she, you know, so she closes range probably to around inside 3,000 yards and unleashes a salvo of 6 torpedoes and they all go thunk. Imagine that, you know, and she gets the contact report off, which is really good for Willis Lee and his battle force.
Yeah. So moments after getting this report, Captain Davis aboard Washington gets on the ship's announcement system on the PA or whatever you want to call it. And he says, quote, and this is important. He says, "We're going into an action area. We have no great certainty what forces we will encounter. We may be ambushed. A disaster of some sort may come upon us, but whatever it is we are going into, I hope to bring you all back alive. Good luck to all of us." So, end quote. The message that he's giving his people is like, hey, just to let you know,
right?
Things may go badly for us, but you know, and he's not carrying a doom and gloom kind of a look about it as some other admirals, Gormley, would have done so. He is basically telling his people, like, look, this might suck, but we're going to come out of this and we're going to do well. And he had every reason to be fully confident, not just for the reasons that we spoke about earlier with the gunnery department and everything else, but Washington was a well-oiled machine at this point in the war. Even though, you know, this is her first dip of the keel into the blue waters of the Pacific, she's a well-oiled machine. She'd been around the bend and over the hill several times. Now, that being said,
But Seth, just a couple of points here. This announcement went just to the crew of the Washington,
correct,
as right. I recall. Mm-hmm. And remember the words here, "I hope to bring all of you back alive." We're going to revisit that later.
Yep. So we talked about this in the lead. And the previous night, the cruisers, Japanese cruisers, had come and bombarded Henderson Field relentlessly. And Admiral Kondo, and John, maybe you can give us an insight on this. Admiral Kondo thought that, you know, possibly that the Henderson was out of action from the pasting that was delivered by the cruisers that night, even though it never really had been knocked out of action ever.
Right.
So I'm not sure where the hell he's getting this information or why he would have thought this would have changed. But to that end, he thought that there was no way that there's going to be American ships offshore tonight. You know, we're going to have a free hand. We should be free and clear. He was wrong.
He was wrong. Yeah. I think what you're sort of seeing there is it's reasonably early in the war, and there's not a really good understanding, frankly, among a lot of the combatants, is just how difficult it is to permanently knock an airfield out of commission. And certainly from the, you know, the Japanese side, they haven't really internalized that yet. That, yeah, you may have been bombarded this place 2 nights ago, but guess what? You know, the Americans have got bulldozers and gravel, and I can, you know, I can scrape, you know, a hole closed, and that, you know, particularly with Marston matting, I can, yep, I can get that, you know, field up and running again. So yeah, a couple hours. The lack of naval opposition, I mean, you can sort of understand where he's coming from on that as well, in that, you know, we've just fought this tremendous naval battle 2 nights before, and we know that we punished the Americans as a result of that. Mm-hmm. If nothing else, you know, they've got the sighting from the submarine that sank the Juno, you know, that there was an American battle force limping out of the Sound. So there is, though, a chronic problem, I think, in the Imperial Navy of a sort of best casing, that they chronically go into these contests without a sense of proper caution around what might be awaiting them. And it's gonna bite them in the butt here again too.
Big time. So unlike the Friday the 13th battle, where there was, you know, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face practically. Yeah. This night is a little bit different. And this is important because, you know, you got to sometimes, on some occasions in this night, you got to see what you're shooting at. It was clear. The night was clear. It was moonlit by a quarter moon and enough to see visually, but still enough darkness to hide in if need be. Willis Lee brings his force into the sound. He brings his force into the area, and there's a radio transmission that goes back and forth that is legendary, specifically of this battle, but of the war, you know, from the war, frankly. And it's as they eased into the sound, radio watch picked up a transmission, and there was an unknown voice aboard a USPT boat.
Yeah.
They were confirming that they were tracking a large target. That large target more than likely was USS Washington. And immediately the Task Force 64 gets on the radio on the TBS and says, "This is Lee." Well, the PT boat skipper says, "Who is Lee? You know, who the hell is Lee?" At this, Admiral Lee said, "Nope, this ain't happening." He snatches the radio mic and he says, in the clear, he says, quote, "Cactus, this is Lee. Tell your big boss, Ching Lee is here and wants the latest information." So he's talking to about Vandergriff, theoretically. That's who he's referring
to. They were friends, or at least they knew each other, right?
Well, right.
Yeah, they did. They were, you know, somewhat aware of one another's existence. The PT boat skipper basically disregards this and gets on there and says, oh, quote, "There go two big ones, but I don't know whose they are." And then Lee gets back on the radio and he says, "Refer your big boss about Ching Lee's Chinese. Catchy, call off your boys." At that point, the PT says, or PT skipper says, "Identity established. We're not after you." And then to make it even more of a, you know, kick right in the stones, he says, Lee says, "Peter Tear," meaning PT, says, "This is Lee. Stand clear. We're coming through." It's just,
yeah.
Just get the hell out of my way. I'm coming in here to do some work.
Your little plywood dinghies out of my way. Yeah, I've got real ships here tonight.
Yeah, I'm coming in here to kick some ass. So just make way.
They were expendable, though, and those plywood things did a lot of damage during the war.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah, especially at Surigao Strait.
Yes.
All right. So aboard Washington, the radar picture starts to take shape as Kondo's force enters the area. The initial contact
operating in a distributed fashion too.
Right.
We should mention that.
Yes.
Kondo's, you know, main group is being supported by one of the light cruisers and some of the destroyers, but another group of destroyers and one of the light cruisers is actually swept around further into Iron Bottom Sound, and they actually catch wind of Lee's formation before they're actually picked up on radar. Mm-hmm. So here's another instance of, you know, really good Japanese lookouts, particularly if you've got a decent moon to work with, are actually in the process of stalking Lee, and he doesn't actually know that.
Yeah, that, which is terrifying if you think about it too, because he could have, instead of being the ambusher, he could have been the ambushee.
Which is a chronic problem in Iron Bottom Sound, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
As the news of the radar picture is relayed to Lee, and this, again, just, I mean, the cool of a customer as they freaking come, man. He's aboard a battleship knowing he's about to get into a slugfest with a superior Japanese force. And he takes a drag off of his cigarette. He was a chronic chain smoker.
Yeah.
And he turns around and he looks at Captain Glenn Davis, and just as cool as a cucumber, he smiles and he says, "Well, stand by, Glenn. Here they come."
Right.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
I mean, the confidence is just oozing out of the man's pores.
Yeah.
So Davis gives the order to load the big guns, and aboard both battleships, they do that very thing. They train these things to starboard, and the radar is tracking the targets as they're coming in. And you made this point earlier, John, and this is so very important. We talked about it in the barroom brawl. Bill and I talked about it at Cape Esperance. You know, there were this era of American admirals were rather untrusting of radar, whereas Willis Lee was a firm believer before he ever even used it in combat. He was he was out there preaching.
And we'd call him an early adopter.
Yeah, he is an early adopter, absolutely.
And practitioner. I mean, he is watching this picture develop, or at least at the very least being relayed this information as the picture develops. And he has in his mind exactly what the hell is going on at every minute of this fight is, well,
never loses situational awareness.
Right.
We should mention too that, you know, for all that this engagement depends a lot on radar, the optics are good enough this night that, you know, both of these battleships have their optical rangefinders are working the solution too. And so we really do have sort of a hybrid fire control solution developing where the radar of the era was really good at being able to detect the range to the target. It was much more effective than an optical system could do. But typically, in terms of measuring deflection, again, a 1942 era radar, even an SG, is not going to be as good at measuring deflection as an optical rangefinder will. So,
yeah, bearing, right.
Correct. So in a sense, you've almost got the best of both worlds here, in that there's at least enough light that optical system is giving good inputs to the system as well.
Yes, but this is going to bearing.
But, you know, that said, radar is absolutely crucial in terms of informing Lee's situational awareness of what the overall tactical dispositions look like.
At 23:13 hours, so this is just a short time after the radar picture starts coming up and everything else, the enemy, as you said, John, to your very point, was visually sighted. We could see the Japanese. They were visually sighted from the Washington at a range of 11,000 yards. That's pretty damn close, man.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
It's cage fight.
Yeah.
It's about to be.
Yeah.
It's about to be. Admiral Lee then calls South Dakota's Captain Gatch over the TBS, and he gave him over the radio and gave him permission to fire. Lee puts the radio down, turns to Davis, and he says, "Let him go. Open fire when ready."
Right.
And at that moment, the indicator lights in the main battery, and this is a whole process, you know, for anybody who's ever been aboard a battleship, whether you served or you visited one, you know, there's a whole railway network of lights and things that let everybody know, hey, you know, we're about to shoot these things. There's a couple of buzzers that go off throughout the ship, so literally everybody can just kind of hang on. And finally, at shortly after the order is given, Washington cuts loose, and just seconds later, theoretically anyway, and we can talk about this if we will, South Dakota also cuts loose. She's damaged. Remember, we talked about it. Santa Cruz, she took damage on one of her turrets. But regardless of this, she does fire from her after turret at least once because she sets her Kingfisher afire.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to blow it overboard with her next salvo.
With the next salvo. Right.
But anyway, the first salvo that fires off of Washington almost puts Lee on his behind. It blows the glasses off of his face. He stumbles backwards, and even I don't think as ready as he was for that fight, I don't think he was even ready for that full 9-gun salvo.
Yeah.
Washington shot at the cruiser Sendai. She was tracking Sendai at this moment.
Yeah.
And that's always confused me because he's been aboard for a 9-gun salvo before.
Yeah.
Why did it surprise him so much?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Good question.
But it apparently blew the glasses off the man's face.
Yeah. Yeah, these are immensely powerful weapons.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The Japanese, of course, are unhappily surprised by you know, the enormous waterspouts that start, you know, sprouting up around Sendai and her group. But to that point, you know, Sendai and her group have been aware of the Americans for quite some time. They have actually already put torpedoes in the water that are heading towards Lee's force at this point. One of the problems for the Japanese, though, is that they do not correctly identify the American battleships. Even though they see these, you know, enormous superstructures, they are identifying these ships as super heavy type cruisers. And that's the word that's going back to Kondo on board, I think he's in Otago, that, you know, there aren't battleships here. There are these, you know, mythical super heavy type cruisers, whatever the heck that is. He's going to be disabused of that notion here fairly shortly. But again, the Japanese are best casing things and are not really fully grasping what it is that they're up against until the water column starts shooting up around Sendai. And it's like, holy Moses, you know.
And John, let me fill in the blanks for the listeners, because there's more to it than just misidentifying the ship so you shoot at the wrong ship. When you don't have radar to determine range, in fact, submarines still do this today. If you're not going to illuminate somebody with radar and give away the fact that you're there when you're on a submarine, the way you determine range is by a calculation using something called masthead height. So if you know how high the ship is, and in order to do that, you need to understand what class it is. Right. So if you know what the class it is, you know how high the masts are. You use that height to calculate geometrically the range to that ship by the angular, you know, intersection of the height of that ship, right? So by misclassifying the ship, they're going to get the range wrong.
Right.
And as you properly pointed out earlier, our big advantage was the radar allowed us to get the range right. If you get the range wrong, your fire control solution is going to be wrong and you're going to miss. So it's really important that they misclassified the battleships at this point.
Although that is really important for Kirishima's gunnery later on down the road. The advantage, of course, that the Japanese have is that torpedoes are essentially a fire and forget weapon.
That's correct.
Yep. You know,
on the other hand, there's you're shooting not at the ships, but at an intercept point
where it's going to go,
where the ship is going to be. Like the old I don't skate to the puck, I skate to where the puck's going to be kind of thing, right? And so you still need to understand the range to know that. Now, there were optical ranging systems on these guns, and so that's not what you would use for the torpedoes, to your point.
Well, actually, intriguingly, for the Japanese, their torpedo fire control systems were in some ways more sophisticated than their gunnery fire control systems. They could do things like they could do blind fire solutions. They could take into account, okay, well, I used to know that this target was moving in this direction on this speed. Oh, it's gotten obscured by smoke, but my computer tells me I still think it's going to be, you know, in this
shoot.
Right. So they had really good systems for their torpedoes. And the other thing is, too, that if I've got four destroyers and nine tubes or whatever per destroyer, you know, just by sheer math, if the length of the enemy battle line is X thousand yards long, if I put enough torpedoes in the water ahead
of
that away, I won't hit something. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. And that's what happens. As I say, you throw enough stuff at the wall, some of it's bound to stick.
That's correct.
So, Washington fires at Sendai at a long distance. I forget what the exact yard is. 11,000. Well, I just said 11,000 yards. She fires at 11,000 yards. The first salvo is over. The next salvo straddles. And that's when the captain of the Sendai says, not today, Jack. See you. Goodbye.
Bye. Yeah, exactly.
Being a cruiser skipper, he knows that the next one is probably going to be in my lap.
Right.
Washington gets a weird radar flicker on her third, because she does fire again a third time. She lets loose a third salvo at Sendai, but by now Sendai's already come about and she's beaten feet.
That whole group is just like,
they're gone.
You know, this is perfect torpedo tactics on the part of the Japanese. Mm-hmm. They've got their fish in the water, as the Japanese habitually did. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need to keep closing the target. Those torpedoes have got enough range that they can, you know, probably reach Noumea. So, you know, put the fish in the water and run away. That's what they do.
Yep. So the American van of destroyers, God bless them. You know, we talked about the four DDs that are at the van of this column. They get into a hell of a scrap. And you know, the American column, I forget exactly how long it is, but it ain't that damn long.
No, we only have six ships.
Yeah, what is it, like 1,000 yards in between each ship, I think? I don't even know if it's that much.
Not even that.
Oh. Yeah.
You know, but like 600 in some cases.
The destroyers get in there, and I mean, they just get waylaid, man. I mean, they take a beating. Within 10 minutes, both Walk and Preston are hit by accurate Japanese gunfire, and of course, no surprise here, torpedoes. Yeah. They're hit by torpedoes. Preston may have also, and this is something that I do want to say, Washington, while she's firing her main battery, and South Dakota is too, Washington's secondary battery on her starboard side is popping off. And there is some indication that, yeah, Preston may have been a victim of Washington's secondary battery.
It was a 5-inch guns.
Yeah, 5-inch 38. Yeah, it's they didn't sink her, but there's evidence that actually Washington may have put a couple of secondary salvos into Preston. Mm-hmm. Benham has her bow blown off by a long lance. She sinks later the next day.
Part of the course.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like, you know, second verse, same as the first. The Gwen is hitting her engine spaces and retires from the fight. At this point, Lee is aware that all four of his destroyers have been hit. Half of them are sinking. At 23:48, he orders them to retire. Just go. You can get the hell out of here and just go. And this leaves
two battleships against how many Japanese ships at this point?
14.
14.
Yeah. 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not measuring up to be anything very good on the American side. However, Japanese destroyer, I think it's Ayanami, is it?
Ayanami, yeah.
Yeah. Ayanami is taken under fire by Washington's secondary battery. And she is repeatedly hit and eventually does sink. And, you know, so now we're drawing blood as the secondaries on Washington are just shredding. And John, you talked about the 5-inch 38s on a battleship before. Yes, it's basically strapping an Atlanta to each side of the battleship.
Yeah, that's essentially right. Yeah.
It's nuts. It's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, as I'm thinking about this, you know, 5-4-90, yeah, you got 18 5-inch 38s between these two battleships that are blazing away. That's a lot of boom, boom.
Yeah, that's a lot of firepower. Yeah.
And since the range is so short, it's an effective firing range for those guns as well.
And particularly on the target, they're shooting at a destroyer. They're not shooting at a battleship. So these 5-inch hits can and do wind up sinking this Japanese destroyer. Credit is actually given to Washington, but it's more than likely she probably shares credit with Gwen, I believe it was.
Right.
But regardless of this, you know, we're drawing blood here. But even then, you know, we haven't fired at the big target yet. But before we do that, I mean Washington, because we're all, you know, vicariously sailing aboard the decks of USS Washington at this moment. South Dakota, John, let's talk about SODAC here, because for all the good that she did in Santa Cruz, and I firmly say that South Dakota and Swede Vetiza are the reason that Enterprise survives Santa Cruz. Right.
This was not a good fight for South Dakota. She scored some own goals, to use the soccer parlance. She ends up tripping her own circuit breakers, I believe twice actually. And the result is that all the electronics on the ship go dead. And from a ship handling standpoint too, she makes a tremendous error in that she's got these flaming American destroyers in front of her, and she's got to swerve out of line to avoid those. She makes the mistake of swerving out of line to starboard, which means she passes in front of those burning wrecks, which then illuminates her from behind for the main Japanese gunnery force that is coming down on the other side of Savo Island. So
she allows herself to be silhouetted.
Correct. And that's not a good way to be. No. You can kind of understand it in that you're fairly close aboard to Guadalcanal and, you know, you don't want to get into shoal waters, obviously, but you know, the result is, yeah, she's silhouetted and she's now a perfect target.
Yeah. And
you know,
and
those breakers tripping, I'm sorry, we still do shock trials on our ships. In fact, I went through one to make sure our breakers don't trip the way South Dakota's did during this battle.
So here's the thing, and this is what's inexcusable about this, is that South Dakota had fired their main battery in training several times before, and they were aware that this was a problem. They were aware that the circuit breakers would trip if you tied them down, physically tied them down. The chief engineer aboard USS South Dakota was explicitly told, do not do this.
And did.
Yet he did it anyway.
Yeah.
And this is why South Dakota loses juice. It's because the guy just basically, well, he didn't basically, he straight up disregarded regulations and said, And this is why she loses juice. I do not know the gentleman's name. I have no idea what happened to him, but
there's
probably a
reason for that. But I'm thinking he didn't make flag rank. And not at all. That's a career limiting move. And you need to understand too, that all of US warships in general had more electrical systems than hydraulic systems, because our hydraulic industry actually was not as well developed as either the Germans or the British. And so we depended very heavily on electrical driven drives to do things like train turrets. Mm-hmm. So if you trip your circuit breakers, I mean, you've got a real problem on the ship. You know, no can do. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are backup generators, but again, if the power bus is compromised, even if you bring those generators online, you could potentially have a problem. And I think that may actually have been what trips the circuit breakers the second time around. But yes, SODEC is...
Yeah, it's called synchronizing out of phase when you close the breakers if you're not perfectly in phase. The only thing you could really do with that power on these ships was, you still have propulsion and you still have steering. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that is it. Yeah, because I mean, Lee couldn't even raise Gatch aboard South Dakota via radio. Couldn't get him on the horn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to let the viewer slash listener understand, Washington's in the lead. The destroyers are literally flaming wrecks. God bless them. Washington's in the lead. She goes behind the flaming wrecks, so she's hidden from view. Whereas SODEC, to your point, John, goes in front of the, or I guess you'd be in front of them, and she is literally, boom, stage lit from behind, saying, Here I am.
And it's at this juncture when SODAC's enormous superstructure finally comes into view for the Japanese that the light bulbs, go on in Kondo's brain and, of course, in the gunnery officers on Kirishima, that this is an enemy battleship. And they waste no time in illuminating and firing everything and the kitchen sink at South Dakota.
Illuminating with the searchlights?
Yeah, they're using searchlights at this point. Mm. And that was the Japanese don't have radar. And so in the initial portions of an engagement, their doctrine was to illuminate using searchlights. And then they will fire on the target until her own internal fires as the result of that gunfire illuminate the target sufficiently that they think can flip the searchlights off and retreat to darkness. So the searchlights go on, and in the lovely words of Rich Frank, down these incandescent alleys come, Japanese shells pretty much by the bucketful. Again, the range here is pretty darn close. We're talking probably about 7,000 yards. From an armor penetration standpoint, Kirishima probably can't get through South Dakota's armor, but what ends up happening is her superstructure just gets perforated.
Yeah, it does.
With all manner of 5-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch, and even a couple of 14-inch hits as well.
She becomes, as I put it in the notes, a tactical punching bag.
Yeah.
For the Japanese. I mean, they don't know Washington's there.
Correct, because Washington is hidden by the backdrop of Guadalcanal and that black mass. So they cannot see Washington at this point.
When the Japanese get word that an American battleship is like, oh Jesus, there it is. Their force, we've already talked about Sendai and her people, they're gone. But the other Japanese ships that are surrounding Kirishima or near Kirishima, they execute a bunch of maneuvers, and I frankly tried to track it, and it's like we talked about throwing spaghetti on a plate.
It's complex. And I would say for the listener again, there's a wonderful study written by a guy named Robert Lundgren, who looks at this gunnery action in very great detail. He did another good study of the hood action as well. But Lundgren's study, you can, just Google it, and it's well worth reading if you want to nerd out on the actual track courses. But yeah, basically the Japanese start moving into more of a broadside configuration against South Dakota, and it's really Kirishima and the two heavy cruisers that are just open up on her. And this is a characteristic of night fights in general, that whatever... any target that the opposing forces can see, there's no fire discipline. Everybody shoots at that target. And yeah. So, you know, yeah. So South Dakota is on the receiving end of Godzilla-sized helpings of Japanese firepower.
Absolutely. And the important part of what you just said is that the Japanese forces become separated. So now it's just Kirishima and the two cruisers.
Correct.
That are within both visual. I mean, everything's in gunnery range of Washington and South Dakota, let's be real. But
yeah,
that's what they're looking at now.
Right.
And Willis Lee is watching South Dakota taking a beating. But, and this is very, very important here. So you're, you know, the listener's going, well, why the Christ didn't he shoot?
Yeah.
Because we mentioned that they were installing the radar, the SG radar sets aboard USS Washington and when Willis Lee was there. Now, Willis Lee had input on where to put the receiving sets, where to, you know, look at the screens and everything so he could get the reports. He had no input at all as to where to actually put the radar, the exterior portion of it himself. That was Bureau of Ordnance that said, it will be here. You will not move it here. You will not move it anywhere else. Why is this important? Because Washington can't see behind her.
It's a blind arc.
It's a blind spot. He, as great as the SG system is, where it was placed aboard Washington, there's a blind spot behind him. So him being Lee, he can't see where the hell South Dakota is. So he doesn't know. His radar is tracking a large target, which of course turns out to be Kirishima, but he doesn't know that because as spatially aware as he was, and he was, he knows that his battleship, his friend, is now blacked out and he doesn't know where the hell it is.
Yeah. And he's reasonably sure, of course, it's somewhere off to his starboard side. Sure. He does not want to do a friendly fire engagement using 16-inch naval rifles against something that may be a friendly target.
So
it's only then when Kirishima actually turns on her spotlights, now the tactical situation clarifies for Lee as well.
Mm-hmm. That's one way to classify your target.
Yeah, yeah.
Turn on the lights.
Well, and this was a known risk. I mean, the Japanese understood this perfectly well, but the game plan here for the Japanese is to do exactly what they're doing, which is to put as many shells on the target as rapidly as possible and knock it out, particularly if you've got an American battleship, and they don't know that Lee is there with a second American battleship. So it's not an unintelligent decision. It just turns out to be one that costs them.
Yeah. So Sodak suffers at least 26 hits.
Yeah.
By mostly 8 and 6 inches, you were saying, John. So I think there's a couple of fives in there. But and then she does take at least one that we know of, 14-inch main battery hit from Kirishima.
Yeah.
I believe it's in her after. Yeah, it's in her after turret. Doesn't penetrate, turret. But gouges the bejesus out of the armor.
Yeah.
Having taken a beating and she's on fire now, and there is a fire threatening. I forget how many fires there were. There were, what over 20?
There were a lot of fires and a lot of them in the superstructure. Again, sure. We have parallels here with what happened to Hiei just two nights before. You know, the fire, the superstructure just goes up in flames.
Yep.
And we have, you know, accounts from Captain Gatch of South Dakota saying that, you know, he was blind. He couldn't see what he was shooting at because, again, our electrical systems are all screwed up. So, yeah. South Dakota's watertight integrity hasn't been damaged a jot, but right. She is essentially firepower killed at this point because her superstructure has been so trashed. Mm-hmm. You know, radars are touchy, delicate things. And, you know, if you hack up the electrical conduits and so forth that are running vertically through that superstructure, you know, the radars don't work. Now what do you do? Yeah. It's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, he does.
You can't replace waveguide like you can replace cables.
Yeah, exactly.
And Gatch does the only thing he can do, frankly, at this point. He says, I'm out of here.
Right.
And he comes about and he goes. He, unfortunately, because of a lack of communication, he does not let Lee know at all that he's gone. He just turns around and says, screw this, I'm gone.
Yeah. And essentially, he puts the pedal down to the metal and keeps heading to the west to get out through the southern channel that is south of Savo Island, and then he's going to beat feet around the western tip of Guadalcanal and head for the barn. But he's hugging the shore and he's heading for the exits.
Yeah. So now
it is one battleship against 13 Japanese warships.
That's it. And again, The chances aren't very good here.
Yeah, pretty terrifying.
But you got the man here.
You got the man, and he's about to do his thing.
Yeah, he is. So he's aware, as we were saying, that Sodak was blacked out. And as you said, John, to your point, when Karishma flicks on those searchlights, that target that Washington's radar had been tracking is now confirmed undeniably as a hostile target.
That's an enemy target.
And there is no doubt about what he's looking at, because he's watching this thing. He now pump rounds at South Dakota. So
he knows what the deal is. And you have to think that there was, you know, spittle coming down the chin of some of these gunnery officers as they're anticipating what's about to happen here.
So at 8,400 yards.
Yes, sir.
Which is stupid close for 16-inch guns.
Well, okay, I want to push back on that, because a lot of people describe this as point blank range. It is not.
No, it isn't.
It is not. One of Washington's officers refers to it as body punching range, and I think that is a good way to term it. You can certainly miss at this range. I mean, it's not like we were, you know, at 2,000 yards or 1,000 yards or 500 yards two nights before. You know, it's a goodly distance, but there's also these guns have tremendous penetrative power at this range. So I have a friend, a guy named Nathan Oaken, who used to program fire control computers for the Navy's SAM systems. And for grins and giggles, about two decades ago, he wrote a face-hardened armor penetration calculator program.
Goodness.
And so you take this thing and you tell it, okay, I'm firing this gun. It has a muzzle velocity of X. It is a range of this. So that means with this shell, it's going to be coming down at this angle on the target. I'm going to be using an American 2,700-pound super heavy APC shell with, you know, windscreen and blah, 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 blah. I'm going up against a Japanese Type C Krupp cemented armor plate of this thickness with this much face hardening on the front end, and it's backed by a 1-inch mild steel backer plate at obliquity this, and yada, yada, yada. You feed all these things into the computer and you push the button, and it'll tell you, okay, is your shell going to go through that armor plate? If it doesn't, does it break up? Even if it does it get deformed? Is the fuse still going to likely work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I used that calculator a number of years ago to simulate this shoot. And using, you know, these 2,700-pound armor-piercing shells against Kirishima's belt at this range, and the results are alarming. At this range, Washington can put a shell through Kirishima's belt, clear through the ship, and out the other belt.
Damn.
Okay. And now that wouldn't happen because, you know, for something like that to happen, the fuse would have to fail. And American fuses were actually very, very good. But it gives you a sense for just the sheer kinetic woof that these big 2,700-pound shells have against what is, again, a World War I design battle cruiser. So at this range, Kirishima might as well have been made of cardboard for all the protective, you know, power that her 8-inch belt gives her. She was just absolutely naked to this gunfire from Washington.
And it's important to note, too, that, as you said, Karishima is a World War One era style, you know, design. Washington is state of the art.
Yep.
I mean, so Sodak too, for that matter. Sodak even more so because she's newer. But regardless of this, these are the state of the art battleships in the world, except for maybe Yamato. But even then, you know,
yeah,
it's arguable.
That we could tank on that forever.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's arguable.
The bottom line is, yeah, when Washington opens up on Kirishima, it's
a matter of time, man.
Yeah.
It's a matter of time. So
I'm going to pile on you to make another point, John. From the fire control calculation standpoint as well, and someone's going to criticize me severely for not knowing this precisely like I used to when I was driving submarines. But
you got excuses.
At 1 mile, 1 degree is something like 190 yards.
Right.
Okay, and this is over 4 miles.
Yeah.
So you're going to miss from a fire control perspective as well at 8,200 yards if you're not very, very precise.
Yes.
And so not only I'm adding to the fuel that this isn't danger close from this isn't point blank range from a battleship, because you can still miss at 8,000 yards.
But keep this in mind, when Washington's training and Lloyd Mustin's watching these shells drop in her wake at 32,000 yards,
right?
8,400 yards, brother.
Yeah.
That's close, man.
That's right.
Right.
That's close.
Yeah.
So she lets loose. She's tracking Karishma, and finally, target confirmed, let her rip. And she does that very thing, fires a full 9-gun, 2,700 pound load of ass whooping.
Yeah.
At Karishma at 8,400 and closing, mind you, yards. Now, Hank Seeley up in spot, he's watching visually. He's watching the shells go and they splash. Now, what he initially thought is that they missed. Like, Jesus, how the hell did we miss this? We missed. They did not. So underwater surveillance in 2019, RV Petrol, Karishma was found by Ballard first, but 2019 Petrol went and did a very
underwater survey,
high tech underwater surveillance of Karishma. Lundgren used that information with your buddy Tully to write his dissertation on the wreck of Karishma, which, by the way, is brilliant. So look it up. It is freaking brilliant. However, my personal experience from this is I was sitting with Rob Kraft after we were finished filming the series that all three of us were on at a table drinking a beer, and he pulled up a bunch of the wreck surveillance that we did not use in the show. And I asked him, I said, you got Karishma in there? And he's like, yeah. And he starts digging around and he pulls it up. Those first salvos did not miss. They did not miss. They plunged what they were shooting at the hull, and they actually plunged just below the waterline and punched right through Karishma's hull.
Yeah. Right through her belt. Piercing shells will go through that water and hit the hull.
You're damn right.
If it's an impact shell, it would probably explode on impact with the water, but not these shells.
So a lot of the quote misses that Washington says occurred were that very type of quote miss. They were underwater penetrations right through the hull.
For the sake of the listener, the conventional wisdom when I was a kid and reading about this growing up and for years and years and years was that Kirishima only took between 6 and 9 16-inch hits.
Nope.
Lundgren, in his analysis, demonstrates, I think, very persuasively that she probably took as many as 20.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember sitting next to Rob and scrolling through the footage, and I counted myself.
Yeah.
I counted 18 myself. No, I'm sorry, 17 myself.
And part of the hole is missing as it's sitting on the bottom, right?
Yeah.
So you didn't even see all of it.
Yeah. So she just got absolutely shellacked. The more I thought about this, I think it's something of a minor miracle that Kirishima didn't just vaporize all of the hood. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about the effect of these shells, which is, they don't have a lot of explosive in them. What they're designed to do is detonate and, into a number of multi-hundred pound chunks and just blow these big chunks, through the hull. She gets hit by, 20 of these shells, which probably equates to 200 some of these chunks getting blown around here, and none of them manage to connect with one of her magazines and blow her to kingdom come. That really is kind of astonishing when you think about it. But she manages to avoid that fate. Within a couple of seconds.
I'm thinking Musashi as well, right? That it didn't explode underwater either, or did it?
Musashi?
No. No, Musashi.
Musashi did, yeah. No,
oh, my gosh.
I'm talking about Kirishima.
Yeah, Musashi's like metal confetti on the bottom of the ocean.
That's right.
Really sad. Mm-hmm. No, Kirishima's reasonably contiguous, her wreck. Anyway.
So
the net result of all of this is, within two salvos, I mean, Kirishima just kind of slobbers out of line and is completely out of control, losing way very quickly. Her rudder has been smashed. So, she's out of the combat you know, pretty quickly.
The thing with the when Hank Seeley's watching these splashes, these misses, and this is important to note from the American perspective, but really bad for the Japanese, is that he thinks he misses, so he nudges the main battery up just like a degree. And at that range, he's correcting. Yeah, he's walking the shells in. Her next salvo smacks that superstructure of Kirishima, 16-inch guns pounding that superstructure at that range. I think it hits, you know, the after-action report, the damage report by the Japanese, by the way, says that second salvo from Washington slammed into her third level bridge and just killed everybody in it, just obliterated it.
Yeah, it's devastating.
Yeah, I mean, it's nasty. I mean, it's nasty. Her third salvo, Washington's third salvo, I mean, you know, she ain't going to fire once and turn around and say, oh, we're done. So, no, I mean, she just keeps pouring it on. Five of the nine shells, theoretically, strike Kirishima amidships with one shell penetrating below her waterline that we know of. Actually, I think it was probably two, causing massive flooding. This is adding to the flooding from the initial salvo. So, I mean, this is just more water is literally cascading across
into these engine rooms.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bad thing.
Which is causing asymmetrical flooding in her hull. So she's taking on a pretty pronounced port list here pretty darn quickly. And again,
which amplifies the free surface effect, which accelerates the list and
all of that good stuff. And World War I vintage designs were not designed to stand up against underwater hits. You have evidence of that same thing. You know, if you look at what happened with the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, Repulse, once she finally got tagged by some torpedoes, I mean, she's just done instantaneously. Kirishima is kind of the same deal. They just can't stand up to a hit like that.
And the hits just
keep on coming.
They keep on coming, man. Lee is not letting this thing get away. And he is just beating the Kirishima to a bloody stump.
Although all of this happens, you know, within 7 minutes or something like that. Yeah. She's out of action within two.
Oh, easy.
So, she just gets pummeled.
As the distance closes, Washington's secondary battery now starts to pump rounds into Kirishima as well. And this is similar to the effect that we were talking about when we were talking about the Hiei and, you know, all the small caliber American ammunition is being poured right into the superstructure. And that's what Washington's doing here. Although there is in the wreck, there is at least one, or no, I'm sorry, two, I think, 5-inch holes in the hull. So maybe they got lucky. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, or it could have been because Kirishima wasn't a barroom brawl. She might have taken a hit there too. It's unknown. I don't think Lundgren was able to identify it. Not damn sure it couldn't.
Right.
But either way, there's untold loss of life aboard Kirishima because all this stuff is hitting where human beings are lurking.
Yeah. Didn't she get hit back aft too and get a jammed rudder because of that?
At least twice, I think. Huh?
Yeah. Her rudder definitely gets conked and she's, you know, tracing clockwise circles in the ocean at this point, but she's losing power so rapidly that really the net effect is that, she just grinds to a halt relatively quickly.
She does return fire at Washington to her credit, and this I think goes into the circumstances of her literally doing this in the water. Even at that range, she misses. The shells sail over Washington. I think one of them actually punches through, or it might have been a smaller caliber shell.
Rigging.
Yeah, it goes through her rigging, and I think one of them pops through one of the smaller radar screens. But that's it. I mean, there's no physical damage done. But yeah, it does cut her rigging down. Some of her signal flags come fluttering down. But as one of the Washington sailors said, an inch is as good as a mile.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, you don't want to get hit with anything of that size, but you know, sure don't want to get hit with that. Kirishima spotters say they hit Washington at least 10 times. I'm not sure where the hell that comes from because I don't even think she fired that much.
Probably not. Yeah. The Japanese were good at overclaiming. Let's just leave that there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good thing we weren't.
No. Well, we were.
But not exactly. To that.
Yeah, not to that. Yeah, really.
So, and does Admiral Lee have a pity for these guys and say, okay, now cease fire?
Not at all, man.
It's pretty clear, though, that she's knocked out very, very quickly. Mm. And, you know, we need to keep keep our eye on the tactical situation that Lee is having to grapple with, is that he knows that he is the lone remaining effective combatant at this point. So,
you know. Even if he takes Kirishima out, there are still 12 other Japanese warships.
Right. And a lot of torpedoes out there, and he knows it. So
that are in the water by now.
Correct.
Yep.
So Kirishima, as she's circling, she shows her stern to Washington. And Washington, at this point, Lee's like, all right, enough is enough. Let's go. And he starts to turn away. Washington still lets loose another salvo. And this one, I believe, is this last one. She's been hit in the rudder, and the rudder is jammed, and that's why she's turning. But it's one more, again, the old finger in the eye, man. It explodes right underneath her keel, right underneath that rudder, and that rudder, it ain't happening. I mean, there is no... nothing is going to stop that thing or free that thing. So,
which means she doesn't sink, it's really going to complicate the towing if they try to take her to tow.
Correct.
Yeah. Not going to happen. And don't they try? Don't they at least think? Well,
they do. So, and we can come back to that. But yeah, the Japanese do try to save her. But the first Kirishima's captain orders Nagara, a light cruiser, to come. In front and pass a towing cable off. And Nagara's skipper looks at this wallowing battleship and she's just like, sorry, that's not going to happen. Then they tried using a pair of destroyers and briefly passed a tow. But, Kirishima is taking so much water at this point that, again, the free surface effects that you alluded to, Bill, you can see the ship she's healing back and forth because we have these rushes of water below decks that are affecting her. So it becomes fairly obvious fairly quickly that they are not going to be able to save her. When the abandoned ship signal is finally given, she actually ends up going over very quickly. So quickly, in fact, that the Japanese destroyer Terazuki is almost caught underneath Kirishima's superstructure as it's coming down into the water, barely misses this destroyer. There's, I think, some ambiguity in the Japanese sources. They say that she was scuttled, and I'm like, you can say what you want. Yeah, she was clearly sinking. And the rapidity with which she went over, to me, indicates that she was not scuttled. So. No. That's where I'm at.
Not structurally sound.
Right. Yeah. She's sinking is what she's doing.
Yeah. Well, 21, 16 inch shell hits is going to do that to you.
Yeah. Generally, when ships are scuttled, they don't capsize. They try to bring, if you're listing the starboard, you try to, cause flooding on the port side.
Right.
And that wouldn't, and so that, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. She's a mess.
So at this point, Kondo orders a withdrawal. I mean, his main punching power, Kirishima, has literally been shot to pieces. And Kondo's fully aware, he's got to be, that American battleship just did this to my battleship. She's still there and she ain't hurt.
Yeah.
And we don't really know where she is. And God help us if this thing gets a hold of us again. So let's get the hell out of here. Probably smart, because Washington was indeed tracking one of those cruisers. I don't remember which one.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. Yeah, I'm sorry. Lee is tracking a cruiser and one of the destroyers with his after turret, but still not knowing where Sodak is, refuses to allow the opening fire order to be given.
Right.
At this point, what does Lee do, John? He doesn't just turn around and go.
No, and it's really kind of gutsy. I mean, he faints to the northwest briefly, as if he's going to go after this convoy that the Japanese have been trying to bring down to this island for the last 2 days, which forces the Japanese to react to that maneuver for at least several minutes. But then eventually he decides that discretion is the better part of valor, and he brings Washington around to the south. I think here is just another brilliant example of seamanship on his part. He's aware that probably South Dakota and certainly the two remaining mobile destroyers in his screen are going to be hugging the western shoreline of Guadalcanal as they're trying to get south and out of this engagement. And so when Lee disengages, he makes sure that he is on the far western side of that channel as he's
at the seaward.
Yeah, uses seaward channel to make sure that if the Japanese are following him, that they're going to pursue him and not his wounded former compatriots. Mm-hmm. So, and he's right to be concerned too, because the Japanese have a lot of fish in the water at this point. And as Washington is exiting, there are a number of pretty close calls where some of these long lances go by, you know, just by a matter of yards on either side of Washington.
Yeah, and some of them explode in her wake. I mean, they're
That's correct. They're close. Yeah, I mentioned it. Yep.
Yeah, they're close. So, as you said, the Japanese order a torpedo attack, and then they're like, "All right, we're out of here. We're done. Goodbye." And they leave at a little after midnight at 00:33. That's when Lee orders a retirement, still observing torpedoes in his wake. By 01:10, the Japanese are also gone. The battle is effectively over.
300 guys go down on Kirishima. And again, you know, it could have been, honestly, it could have been a lot worse when you really think about it.
So it must have rescued a lot of the folks that abandoned ship, which wasn't common. Particularly at night, it's really hard to find those guys.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, her complement's got to be over 1,000 guys. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's about 1,200, 1,300, something like that.
So, I mean, 300 going down with the boat is, frankly, I mean, 300 lives is 300 lives. But considering what it could have been, it's not as bad.
You know, I'm astonished she didn't lose half of her crew easily.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Yeah. So South Dakota suffers 38 men killed in action and a further 60 are wounded from the pummeling that she takes. The American destroyers suffer losses in excess of 200 men killed in action. The Washington suffers one punctured eardrum and one hand abrasion.
What was that announcement over the 1MC before the battle began? I'm going to try to bring all of you men home.
Yeah,
Davis does that very thing.
Except for an eardrum. Yeah, that's not a bad, that's not a bad night's work.
No, I've suffered a punctured eardrum. It's not fun, but it beats the alternative.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the implications on what happens here, or because of what happened here, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, from the Japanese perspective, this is a terrible blow. You know, there is a growing realization within the Japanese Navy at this point that we just can't keep this up. I mean, we've lost two battleships in two nights. You know, this is not sustainable. And this kicks off, actually, an active debate within the Navy as to whether or not, you know, we need to call off the campaign or not. This is further complicated by the fact that the Japanese army on this island is starving to death.
Literally.
And so, honestly, the army has a lot of kind of moral cachet at this point. There's a famous incident when Masanobu Tsuji, and we talked about him offline, he's an army officer, ends up, after the failure of the Sendai Division's attack, he makes his way out of the jungle, you know, gaunt and emaciated, and ends up in truck on board Yamato, which was joked, you know, even within the Navy, they called it the Yamato Hotel, because it had air conditioning, you know, that was unheard of. And, you know, the food is great.
The best food.
Yeah. You know, and so Tsuji, you know, makes his way into the wardroom and is, you know, treated to a meal and is describing the conditions on Guadalcanal to the assembled Japanese naval officers. And, you know, would you like a little more, you know, Cabernet, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Could you pass the Grey Poupon?
So the army at this point has got the ability to say, what do you mean you're going to be calling off the campaign? We got 20,000 guys on this island that you guys have failed to keep in supply. So there's going to be a very active debate that's going to go on here for the next couple of weeks in the Imperial back at GHQ in Tokyo as well as to what's going to happen here. Originally, the decision was, we're not giving up. We are going to keep going through this campaign. But eventually, some of the army experts and some of the civilian economics experts come in and say, if we keep doing this, in order to really sustain the size of force on Guadalcanal that we need to sustain, we're going to start distorting the civilian economy. We just haven't got enough shipping to make this happen. And so then you get a second decision on both the Army and the Navy's part. We're done with this. We need to figure out a way to extract the remaining troops off of Guadalcanal, get them out of there, and start, you know, figuring out what the end game in the Solomons is going to be.
This but is this, in November, right? Where this conversation
happening? November, December. Early December is okay. When this kind of all goes down.
But they don't actually extract for another, 2 months?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the last troops on Guadalcanal are not going to be extracted by the Japanese until February of 1943. Mm-hmm. But you can make a very clear case that this gunfire action ends the campaign, in effect.
Yep. Because this is not a problem that their equivalent of a Halsey could have fixed, because we were in much the same situation with the Marines not being supplied. And then, you know, Vandegrift browbeats Halsey, and Halsey commits to doing whatever we need to do to resupply those Marines. It is not equivalent, is it?
Well, like I say, I feel like the Japanese really did have opportunities to win this campaign, particularly in October. You know, the situation was just dire for the Marines at that point. But they really needed, that was their opportunity to push all their chips into the middle and say, you know what, that first battleship bombardment worked really, really well. We're going to be doing that once a week from now on, you know, and just, you know, putting in the units to bring this thing to a close. I think by the time you get to the middle of November, you know, it's tougher for the Japanese to turn it around. But again, what happens if four Congos had showed up on the night of November the 13th and not only destroyed Callahan's force, but also bombarded Henderson such that that convoy could come in and resupply the Japanese then? Does Halsey look at that and say, you know, do I really want to risk my two remaining battleships against four Japanese battleships? What if the Japanese had gotten really gutsy and said, screw it, I'm bringing Yamato and Mutsu down to the party too. We're going for it.
So it was winnable.
It was winnable. I think it absolutely was. I don't know what that means in terms of the long-term prognostication for this campaign, but I think you can certainly say that at the tactical level, the Japanese, even now, if they were willing to shove the heavy surface units into the table, Willis Lee can't beat four Congos and Mutsu and Yamato. He can't
do
it.
I don't care who he is. No.
It's not,
this is a wonderful example of a tactical victory with outsized strategic implications.
Yes,
because
sir.
It effectively ended the Guadalcanal. One battleship, the USS Washington, effectively ended the Guadalcanal campaign. But we didn't know it yet.
Right.
We don't know it, and the Japanese don't know it themselves.
And then, that's what you just said, Bill, is incredibly important to note, is that, I mean, not taking credit away from any of the previous combatants, be they, you know, USS Atlanta or Enterprise or Hornet or the Marines hugging in the foxholes or holding in the foxholes down there on Guadalcanal. But the decision was made by this one cat and this one ship right here. Was it the savior of Guadalcanal? No, I'm not saying that. No. But this action, you know, I've called it this for years, the final nail in the imperial coffin at Guadalcanal. It's this right here, this naval action.
And the Japanese look at it that way as well. I mean, they say afterwards that, you know, this was the fork in the road.
Yep.
And from this time forward, we just didn't think that the campaign was winnable. It's one thing to lose one battleship one night. Okay, you know, that's a bummer. We can deal with that. But the fact that they're losing two of them, just boom, boom, you know, that starts to amplify the tension level. It's like, we cannot sustain this level of attrition. We only have 11 battleships in our total inventory.
Yep. And to the American side, you know, Washington is unscathed. Sodak has taken a pounding. Sodak goes back to the United States. She goes to Pearl, but then she goes to the United States. We don't get another battle wagon back in theater until North Carolina comes back, which is admittedly is not long after this. And then we don't start getting the rest of the South Dakotas. Like Alabama is out in the Atlantic until 43.
Yes.
But Massachusetts and Indiana, they do make their way into the Pacific. And I don't remember the exact dates, but they do make it in there relatively soon. So we are building up that battleship force, and our cruiser force is still pretty much beaten to a pulp.
Yeah.
But the carrier force starts recovering as well.
Not yet.
No, the carriers. Yeah. I mean, 1943 doesn't.
Well, 43, the Essex start coming in, but not in November 42. That's the point, you know. Right. That's the point.
Yeah, at this very moment, early December is when the Essex is going to be commissioned. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it requires months and months to work a ship like that up, too.
Sure. Yeah.
So, I was going to mention, too, that, you know, there's some bad blood that comes out in this engagement between Washington and South Dakota, because South Dakota, you know, the American press, well, the American Navy didn't want to release the news that Washington was still in theater. And so South Dakota ends up getting the credit for this particular naval victory. And there is evil, evil blood between both of those battleships as a result of that.
A lot of enemy fights.
Yeah, a lot of bar fights and so forth. You can achieve
great things if you don't care who gets the credit.
Yeah,
but that's not what happened here.
Right. Well, I don't know if you're aware of the nickname that Washington's crew gives to South Dakota, taking you know, the initials S and D, and we can't say it on the air, but yeah.
Look it up, guys.
I can imagine.
Excremental male appendage. Anyway, these two ships do not have any love for each other as a result of this,
to the point where Willis Lee has to basically say enough of this crap,
stop it.
I mean, he himself has to, Lee has to insert himself into this feud between the two ships and say this crap ain't going on anymore, enough.
Right.
So it is nasty. It is definitely nasty.
So to what extent did this elevate the stature of Lee during the war? We know here we are talking about him 80 years later. So clearly he's cemented in naval history, right? His reputation is cemented.
So,
but during the war, did it make a big difference?
Yes and no. And we could go, and we will talk about this in future episodes. So he is the battleship man.
Yeah,
he's the U.S. Navy's battle wagon big boy. You know, he's the head banana for the most of the war, not all of the war, but most of the war. He clamors for another opportunity to do this very thing against the Japanese, and he actually has a couple of opportunities to potentially do a couple of these engagements, notably in the Philippines,
where
he is not turned loose by Halsey in time. And it is a matter of record that had Halsey said, oh, you know what, Willis, you
go do that San Bernardino thing.
You take your Iowa class battleships and Washington and all your South Dakotas, and you go kick that ass all day long. They had enough time and fuel. He could have gotten out there, but Halsey was like, wait. And then Lee missed his opportunity.
And Lee was not looking forward to doing that at night. Would have preferred to do it during the day. Again, his appreciation of the odds, I think, was quite good. And he recognized that, you know, we're fast forwarding here, but his formation was not well trained at that point for a night engagement, and he didn't want to get into it. He would have, I'm sure, if ordered to it. I'm sure he would have performed fine, but
did he ever get promoted to 3-star?
He dies.
That's kind of what I'm wondering.
He dies immediately after the war. He was an inveterate chain smoker, and he was there at the surrender ceremony, and he dies of a massive heart attack, I think within just a couple of weeks after the surrender. Very shortly thereafter.
It's heartbreaking because he gets back home. He's reunited with his wife, who he hadn't seen in four friggin' years.
Yeah.
And he's home. I think, John, to your point, I think he's home like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And he's getting, he's either going aboard a ship or he's coming off of a ship. I forget what it is, but boom, drops dead right there.
Drops dead.
Halsey is also, well, is older than him and also a heavy smoker, but lasts another 12 years, I think, before he dies.
Yeah. And Winston Churchill outsmoked all of them and drank, you know,
lasted into the 60s.
Lasted longer than any other Allied or Axis leader from that war, except Chiang Kai-shek. So,
wow.
Crazy. Anyway.
Maybe we're doing it all wrong there.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Pretty sure not.
I agree.
Well, gentlemen, as fun as this has been, and it has, we do have
it is
to,
time.
It is time, as they say.
It's 2 hours, Seth. So
it is. This is by far our longest one. But, you know, I mean, again, yeah, it's cool. And yeah, we've all been waiting to talk about this. And yes, we were all excited and still are. Exactly. Yeah. But the overall implications of this, aside from the fact that it's battleship shooting, which is just rad, the overall implications of this on the campaign are so, or were so important that this is why we dedicate the time to this.
Yeah.
Which you wouldn't think. You'd be like, oh, I'm in Santa Cruz. This is the one. This is the one. So with that being said, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. Wherever you receive your podcast, give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page there as well. If you are so inclined, please send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. We will respond to you. It might take a little while, but we will respond to you, I promise. So once again, my name is Seth Parrott, and I want to thank you very much for listening. Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. I very much appreciate all the comments on our YouTube channel, so keep that up as well.
John, thank you very much, as always.
Delighted to be here. This was so much fun.
Yes, John.
It was, man. Thank you all very much.
Great having you.
Happy New Year.
See you all soon. Yep. See you all soon.
See you.